Hello, welcome to One Way Or, the podcast, Jewish Questions and Musings, episode number 15. I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, with my co-host, Michael Unterberg.
Hello,
Michael.
How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing well. And we have a special guest in England, Amanda Wright. Hello, Amanda.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. The audience doesn't quite know that it's been a few months in the making to actually talk with you live. There's been contact in Israel and then India, Sri Lanka, India. Now you're in the UK and we're able to have this conversation. So thanks for hanging in there. And we're really excited to have a conversation today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your patience.
Oh, you're welcome. It's also been about 10 years since you and I met in Jerusalem. And I remember that first conversation where I was really amazed at your understanding of health and food and also about people and kind of how we often have a desire about how we want to be, how we want to be healthy, and then what often happens where we go off track. And that in the 10 years I've known you, I see how dedicated you are to helping people actually make a shift and really strong with a Jewish and Torah-based understanding and deep faith in God, that you help people kind of come to themselves and make commitments and also kind of step up into what they're envisioned. Now, I know that's a lot to start with, but I wanted to let those who are listening to have an idea of how I consider you. So you're a yoga teacher, and it's a yoga that... So would you call it Taoist yoga? How do you title that?
I call it Japanese yoga simply because the yoga that I learned, my teacher calls Ki yoga, and most people, a lot of people don't really know what Ki is. People know what Chi is, but Ki is the Japanese version of Ki. And so Japanese yoga is what it's based in the principles of Japanese medicine. And it's completely different to any other kind of yoga. So as soon as people hear Japanese yoga, they're like, what's that? As opposed to, you know, giving it some other funky name. But the original training was Ki yoga.
Okay, and before this, you've been involved with food, holistic food and food as medicine for a long time. How did you get involved with that?
It actually all came together. It's all under the same, it's all part of the same modality. I don't know how much of my background you want me to give, but essentially I had a couple of car accidents, and I didn't know enough about alternative medicine to know what my options were, so I went the conventional route, which left me in pain for many, many years. And I was told that I would never be pain-free, and I was prescribed a cocktail of medication, which included, you know, anti-inflammatories, painkillers, sleeping pills, antidepressants. I was put on an invalid pension, registered disabled, and told that there was nothing to do to rehabilitate me. And, you know, as a single independent woman, wasn't really an option. So I went seeking, basically, and it was a very long 7-year painful journey. And I came across this particular form of yoga. I was asked to do a mitzvah. A friend of mine in Australia, actually in Sydney, needed a sixth person for the teacher to be willing to come and give a private class, excuse me, in someone's home for somebody who had a chronic back problem. So I just laughed. I said, me do yoga, haha, very funny, you know. So she said, it's a mitzvah, just come lie on the floor, which, I mean, that meant I also had to pay for the privilege to come lying on the floor.
Now, is it too personal to ask what the nature of the injuries were that were causing you this pain?
Well, the first accident, I was rear-ended by a drunk driver while I was stationary at a red light. So I had a very severe whiplash. And if anybody suffered whiplashes, they're very underrated. They really are a nightmare. And they not even if the initial pain recedes, they have long-term repercussions.
In your neck, in your spine, and...
Neck whiplash.
Yeah.
Yeah. And being rear-ended means that your head goes backwards. So it's a certain type of whiplash that damages the soft tissue in the delicate vertebrae, around the delicate vertebrae of the neck. So I went to physio because that's all I knew. It was insured, obviously. So I went 3 times a week and basically got no relief whatsoever. And a year later, my physio said to me, look, just go away and get on with life and try not to have any other accidents, because, you know, if you exacerbate that injury, it could leave you paralyzed. So I was like, great, that's lovely. You know, anyway, off I went, had another accident. I guess Hashem was sending me a message the first time, which I didn't quite get. And so this time I was on my way to a meeting at 6 a.m. in the morning, and some guy was late for work, so decided he could cut in front of me, but didn't quite make it. So we had a head-on collision, and I had a whiplash the opposite way. So my head went forward. And one doctor said to me, if I was a wrestler, I wouldn't be allowed back in the ring. Because double whiplashes, you know, most people don't endure what double whiplashes, you know, if the head to go back but in both directions. Yeah. But the second accident, the engine actually ended up almost in my lap, and the battery acid was actually, as I was standing there, destroying my clothes, as, you know, looking down, wondering why.
Well, we lost you, Amanda.
Didn't occur to me that it was because I was covered in battery acid. But somebody came and saw the car and expected to find me on a stretcher somewhere, you know, half dead, because the car was completely written off. So we can't work out to this day how I actually got myself out the car, because they couldn't open the doors. But somehow I got out. And then I ended up in hospital. I was in a collar. I had all sorts of damage to my chest, my breastbones, my knees went into the steering column, my lower back, everything basically. So lots of soft tissue damage. And that on top of the previous accident just exacerbated my neck injury, and they didn't see a hairline fracture there on the CAT scan. In those days, there weren't really MRIs. So I ended up having a prolapse herniation in my neck, and I was pretty much out of action.
So how long was it from the time of the second accident until you were paying for the privilege to lie on the floor in a yoga class?
About 7 years.
And what had you explored in the interim?
Just about everything that you can think of. I went to India, I went to the Himalayas, I looked at Tibetan medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, every kind of different doctor you can imagine, orthopedic surgeon, just about everything that you can think of.
When you say you went there, you mean you literally traveled there to go?
Yeah. I took a small bag because I couldn't carry anything. Oftentimes I couldn't stand up straight, I couldn't walk sometimes, I couldn't hold a pen sometimes. I was just in excruciating pain most of the time.
Was that the time that you'd say was when you, the beginning of your nomadic traveling?
No.
Always a traveler.
Yeah, I mean, my mother died when I was 19, and they took my home away from us because we were dependents and had no proof that we could continue to pay the rent, so they just took their home away. So that was in England. I went to Australia with some friends who invited me, and that was the beginning. I spent 5 years on the road trying to work out what was the meaning of life, why my mother had been taken at such a young age, and what was the meaning of it all.
Well, I don't want to interrupt the story about the discovery of yoga, but I would like to go back to that part of the search also.
Yeah, there's lots of
search. I'm very curious about that search as well.
I don't know. Fire me questions, because I can talk forever.
So about let's go back to the yoga. You start. How long did it take till you had felt a connection?
Initially, we did 3 times a week for 6 weeks, and I basically lay on the floor and could just about do the breathing, which is a special kind of breathing through your belly, which is the way we're supposed to breathe. But most of us forget how to do that. If you watch babies, that's the natural way to breathe. But as adults, we learn to shallow breathe, you know, in the flight or fight response, as if we're running away from dinosaurs the whole time. Most of us forget to actually take a deep breath. So it was very subtle, because I didn't understand the benefits of this belly breathing. I was just doing it and had no idea really of how much impact it would have on me. But after the first 6-week course, 3 times a week, I could just about lift my head off the floor. But I felt inspired somehow. I don't know why. I just felt inspired. So when they asked me if I'd continue on for the second six-week course, I said yes. And I remember the teacher did this posture, basically, where she's lying flat on the ground and she sort of does this kind of sit-up, but she sort of bends in half, just like floats up to sitting completely effortlessly. And it looked so easy, so I started to attempt it, and I couldn't get my head off the floor, and I sat bolt upright. I'll never forget it, and I looked at her and I said, how did you do that? That's physically impossible. The body cannot do that. And she just looked at me and she said, visualize, breathe with intention. Eventually you'll get there, you know. And I thought, no, she's crazy. But yeah, after about a year, I could do it.
I'm sure that was quite a, took a lot of work during that year.
Yeah, an enormous amount of work. But
okay, so when we make the Amanda biopic, there'll be like a montage at this point, and we'll have to pick a really cool training song, you know, while she.
Right, right. Dun, 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 dun.
Right.
During this time, what was your Jewish practice or your connection with Judaism?
Well, I mean, I grew up in an Orthodox home, but my parents were divorced, so we didn't have a man around. And as you know, practicing Judaism without a man around is sort of has its challenges.
Where was this? This is in London?
No, I grew up in a place called Hove, which is a small town, was a small town by the sea, south of London. They recently made us a city, so we're now the city of Brighton and Hove. People may have heard of Brighton because it's got the it's famous for its Sussex University.
Also, nobody there could beat the Pinball Wizard.
Right, exactly. A few films were made there. But yeah, that's where I grew up.
So how old were you when your parents divorced?
Six.
And your mother remained Orthodox, so she continued to raise you in an Orthodox environment, but you felt that because there was no man, it just didn't feel like a fully expressed religious experience?
Well, I didn't know that because I didn't have anything to compare it to.
Right.
We weren't in the sort of community that is very supportive, but I didn't know that either because I had nothing to compare it to. I didn't know Anglo-Jewry was different to other kind of, you know, Judaism. But what I did have was a mother with an awful lot of faith and wisdom, which I also didn't know because she was just mum. You know,
right.
And I had a very amazing Bubba who left me when I was 14. But also, she was just Bubba. But afterwards, you know, as an adult, you look back and you realize how blessed you were to have such tzaddikuses in your life.
Right.
So when my mum went, I remembered how she had been when my Bubba went, and I tried to apply that same kind of emuna, but it was challenging, obviously. But I don't know. I don't know where you get faith from. People have asked me that many times over the years, but I don't know where you get it from. I just seem to have been blessed with it.
And at 19, did you define your orientation to Judaism in any particular way, or you just sort of had this, because of your mother and your grandmother, this sort of Jewish outlook in general?
I definitely didn't define it for sure. I went a little bit off the derech. Mm-hmm. As I said, I hit the road when I was 19, and I was kind of like a bit wild on the road for a few years, you know, as you would be, a bit angry and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of always was aware of when Chagim were and stuff like that. I can't say I was always 100% Shomer Shabbos in that time.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely maintained most of Kashrus and Chagim and all that kind of stuff wherever I was.
And where were you?
Oof. Easier to say where wasn't I, really.
Okay, we could start there. Antarctica.
So I haven't been to Japan.
Yeah.
I was mainly going between Australia and England. I went to Australia and then I had to come back for Mum's stone setting. And I came back, you know, a year later for Mum's stone setting and realised I just couldn't manage in England. So I went back to Australia, but I stopped in lots of places on the way there and on the way back. So, you know, I went through wherever the planes were going, really,
mm-hmm.
or the ships. I went by ship a couple of times from Singapore down to Australia. So everywhere, Asia, America, just you know, I'd look at a map and think, okay, let's stop there and there on the way, and then look at another map and let's stop there and there on the way back.
Now, do you feel you were doing this? Did you have a purpose? Were you driven by a particular goal, or you were just wandering for wandering's sake?
I had no purpose and no goal. After the accidents and I lost my business at that point, I realized I was completely unemployable and I had no real qualifications. And people would say to me, well, what's your five-year goal? And I suddenly occurred to me, I'd never set a goal, I'd never had goals, and maybe there was something wrong with me. So I thought about how to do goal setting and all that sort of thing. And I got quite depressed, actually, because I just couldn't work out how to do it. So, no, I've never really had any goals or ambitions or purpose.
Well, that might be a bit overstated.
No, I think when I was doing that little wild wanderings for 5 years after my mother died, I think it occurred to me at one point that, you know, being a single mum in the 70s was particularly difficult in England. And she worked like a dog to, you know, keep a roof over our heads and keep us educated. And it suddenly occurred to me that what I was doing wasn't really appropriate in her memory, you know, and that I really should do something more worthwhile with my life, out of respect for her, really. So if there was any purpose in my life, it was to sort of have my mum not feel ashamed of me, I suppose.
And who were your continuing relationships with at that point? Family, friends? Who were you touching base with periodically?
I've always been blessed with friends. My oldest friend that I've known since we were babies came with me to Australia on the first trip. And school friends, you know, from teenage years were always just there. I mean, in those days, obviously, there was no email, no mobile phones. I was never a great letter writer. They might get the odd postcard. But they always used to say to me that they knew I'd turn up, you know, sooner or later. And there was always an open door for me when I did turn up. So I've always been blessed with friends, good friends.
But not strong family ties at that point?
No.
Now, jumping back to the yoga, and you're finally a year into the practice, and you're able to do that, what you first considered was an impossible physical, you know, the sit-up pose. And you've already changed your way of eating and your understanding of food and nourishment?
No, not at all. I always ate a little differently to people because of my travels. You know, like I discovered mangoes long before they were in England, and seaweed and tofu and things like that in Asia long before they were in England. So I always sort of would come back to England and my friends would be like, now what? You know, and I'd make them eat weird things. But not with any kind of consciousness in terms of health, no. I mean, I'd always been dieting all my life because I'd always been the kid with puppy fat and then the, you know, chubby teenager and all the rest of it. So I'd always been on lots of different diets. But once I had my car accidents, the weight just piled on and I didn't even think about trying to lose it because I was just sort of more focused on trying to walk, really. Mm.
So how long did it take to walk with comfort?
I'd say after the first 6 months of once I did understand about changing my diet, after 6 months I was pain-free. And I dropped 20 kilos in that time without even trying. Mm-hmm. That was just...
Which is about 40 pounds?
45.
I don't know. But it was a side effect of... my intention at that point was just to be pain-free. And I had a few other health issues that I'd had most of my life. As a side effect of eating well, all those other things just disappeared.
And at what point in this process did you... start to help other people with their eating and also with their bodies through yoga?
Well, what happened was I was doing this yoga with this teacher and then I went away. I can't remember why. And while I was away, a friend of mine had found a book in a car boot sale that was about oriental diagnosis. And I read it and I was fascinated by how you could tell so much about someone's from their face and their nails and their skin and so on. And she'd also just discovered a family living in Brighton who were taught acrobotics, and we looked into it. And it really intrigued me because it sounded similar to what the yoga teacher had been talking about, although I never really pursued what she'd suggested to me about the food. It didn't click at that point. Anyway, I went back to Australia deciding that that's what I wanted to study. Called up the school, and they just closed because the teacher had decided to get into feng shui instead. I was in a health food store one day. This is this hashgacha pratis that you asked me about. I was in this health food store in a queue, and I heard them talking about somebody doing some meridian exams. And I didn't know what a meridian was, and I didn't know there was a school anywhere near the health food shop. So as I got to the checkout, I said to them, "Where is this school?" And they said, "It's upstairs." And I was like, "Really?" I was curious. And at that moment, somebody barged in front of me. Their pie was cold, and they wanted to put it back in the heater. So they asked me if I minded them pushing in front. I said, "Of course not." That was that. Anyway, I went upstairs to explore this school, and as I walked through the front door, I saw a sign saying food is medicine. So I pulled the flyer out, and it was advertising a course, 12-week course on food is medicine. I went to the receptionist, and I said, "I want to do this." And she said, "It's already started." So I think this was around October or November, and it had all been running for about a month. So I said, "When's the next one?" She said, "February." "Well, I don't know about you, but once I decide I want to do something, I don't have much patience. So, okay, I can't wait till February. I really want to do it now."
Well,
so
that fits your undriven, unambitious personality, Amanda.
No, that's not ambition. That's lack of patience. Anyway, so she said, "Leave your details and I'll speak to the principal." But, you know, we never take people halfway through a course. So I'm just about to leave, and this man runs up the stairs. And it was the man that had pushed in front of me in the queue. And she said, "Oh, hang on, the principal's here, but he's late for class, so I'll speak to him afterwards." So I turned around and I said to him, "Excuse me, you owe me a favor." And he said, "Pardon?" I said, "You owe me a favor. I want to do your course, and I let you in front of me in the queue." I think he was so astonished that he just asked me a couple of questions, like, "Did I know anything about the subject?" And I said, "No, not really. Am I allowed to ask questions?" And he said, "Yes," and he took me in.
Good for you.
I said, "If I complete the course, am I allowed to do the exam? Will I get the certificate?" And he said, "Yeah, if you're good enough, you know, if you pass." That was that. So I started, and that was my introduction to the food as medicine part, which is based in five element theory, which is the same principles as macrobiotics. But it turned out that he had been to the Cushy Institute in America, and he didn't really feel that it sort of fitted into Australian lifestyle, so he adapted it. Mm-hmm. Once I started studying that and they were speaking about meridians, I realized I couldn't really understand the one without learning the other, so I signed up for the meridian certificate. And then I got so interested in that, I just basically signed up for all the other certificates and ended up doing a whole Zen Shiatsu diploma with still no intention of using it for anything other than my own knowledge, because I wanted to understand how something as simple as changing your food had given me my body back after years and years and years of top surgeons and neurosurgeons, orthopedic surgeons, telling me that there was nothing could be done. So when you say, when did I start helping other people with it, basically, you know, I know A and I know B, you know A. I'll teach you B. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And can you explain what meridians are? Because I don't know what's going on at this point.
Ask Andrew. He knows.
No, Jin Shinjitsu is not working with meridians, so this is your answer.
They're basically the energy channels. The same way acupuncture works on meridians, acupuncture works on the classic Chinese meridians, and a guy called Masanaga kind of extended them, so they run through the entire length of the body, the legs, the arms, everywhere. We work with 12. There's some people will say there's 24. You know, there's different levels of them, but basically we just work with 12 meridians. And they're the different, they correlate to different organ systems in the body. And the flow of energy through those, it indicates or dictates how well the body's going to be functioning, basically.
And when you say work with, how are you interacting with these meridians?
So I do Zen Shiatsu, which is different to regular Shiatsu. All Shiatsu works on the meridians, but Zen Shiatsu is diagnostic. And the meridians have diagnostic points all the way along them, but they're kind of concentrated in the belly, which is called Hara in Japanese. And so we use what's called a Hara diagnosis, which means that we look like we're palpating the belly, but we're not actually palpating it. We're actually checking energetically the levels in the different meridians where the diagnostic points are. And from that, we can tell a lot about a person's health on many levels. It works on functional, structural, psychological, and emotional levels. So the Hara is predominantly the function of the body, but you can also tell a lot about the history of the person emotionally and psychologically from that as well.
Now you've used talked about the gut to many people.
You hate that word.
You
hated that word. I remember when I did the workshop, the gut brain connection, you did the flyer for me and you said you can't use the word gut, Americans don't like it.
Right, but you made it really clear of how important that was. And you just mentioned the gut-brain connection. And I just saw research, scientific research in the past year about there being scientific evidence now about that the gut has this whole intelligence through the trillions of bacteria, healthy bacteria, or and how that affects the brain. And that's mm-hmm. what you've been talking about the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I'm listening to you, that I know, like a lot, these are the conversations we would have, and then there'd always be someone coming in and asking you specifically for assistance with an issue. And a lot of your language is also through the Torah. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and in a way, when I sit with you, there doesn't even seem to be a distinction between the Japanese yoga or the food and then the teaching that comes from the Torah with you. That so, in a way, we're looking at one stream, but I'd like to see how for you, this the languaging or even your expression of it is kind of intermixed.
Are they parallel practices, or are they actually all part of one greater whole?
It's interesting, because when I set out to do all these modules, one was called Oriental Medical Philosophy, and class one, he put up the Western system and the Oriental system. So the Western system was God, angels, no, how did it work? God, angels, man, something like that. Anyway, I kind of sort of had to put my hand up and say to the teacher at the time that I can't study on that premise. Oh no, sorry, he put the Judeo-Christian model.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, I can't study on that premise because that's an incorrect premise, that, you know, you can't mix Judeo-Christian because they have different belief systems. So he questioned me on it. I told him a little bit about, you know, how we perceive things. And
which
he changed.
Is?
Well, you know, we don't believe that angels are above man, for example, or that man, or that God is man.
Mm-hmm.
And the Oriental system is much more, you know, holistic, that everything has energy, which is much more according to our beliefs as well. That everything is energy and everything is one. So Judaism doesn't really work on the same principles.
It's funny, you know, like, for instance, when you read an English translation, when the Torah says that, when it's talking about that it's forbidden for Jews to consume blood of animals that it is permitted to eat, so it says, Ki hadam hu hanefesh. You know, mm-hmm. that blood has to be treated, which in English is always translated, I think, in a very strange way. The blood, I mean, in regular Hebrew, that means blood is the soul. But that's a Western body-soul you know, physical, metaphysical distinction, which I don't think is what the words are saying. I think it's closer probably to what you're saying in an Eastern sense, because the blood is life. The blood is, the energy flows through the blood, something like that.
Yes, but I think in, you know, it's a whole other conversation, but I think in the West, most people don't understand the difference between nefesh, ruach, and neshama. So it's just automatically all translated as soul, whereas the nefesh and the ruach are very different to neshama.
And how do you explain it? How do you define those differences?
Well, I think neshama is the simple explanation of soul, but I think in terms of life force, nefesh is like more the animal life force, like you say, the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's different kinds of blood in the body from different sources, different kind of, you know, we talk about all the different fluids in the body, and the ruach and the nefesh live in different parts of the body and have different influences over the blood, if you like.
So, how do you describe the ruach?
The ruach is more like it's a higher level than the nefesh. I think that, you know, most of us are operating from nefesh, which is our animal soul, which is basically just survival instincts, you know, how to feed ourselves, how to get through life. And ruach is kind of when you start to become a little bit more spiritual, which is a difficult word to use because, as one of my teachers said, the fact that we have speech makes us automatically spiritual. So what does it really mean to be spiritual? But I think that if you call spirituality more the connecting into your inner self and becoming more of your own oneness and less of your physical self, then I think that's when you start to connect into ruach, which is where you then can flow with the universal energy and become less attached to the material survival needs, which is more of the nefesh's concern. In other words, I think that when you come more into a place of emunah, a place of faith, then you trust your nefesh can get on and do its job, because basically if you're meant to be alive to do something, to do your tikkun here, then Hashem can look after those needs, and you basically have to then figure out how to do what it is that you're here to do. What is your service? What's your tafkid?
So let's talk about your service, your tafkid, like what you've been doing. Did you want to say it in a different
way? Well, it was obvious to me also to address what you're saying, that you had all these wanderings without what you consider being any goal. And now, from what I know about you as being so strong in wanting to share with others very simple steps they could take to really bring the power into their lives, to bring basically God's life force that is theirs to actually live it. And I'm wondering at what point you saw yourself. And
well, can you even just describe like what you do, what you bring, and where you do these things, and for whom?
Okay. I just want to go back though to the question about paralleling the Torah stuff with the Oriental medicine. When I was studying Oriental medical philosophy, I was gifted with somebody who I'd helped a book that's basically is a Jewish medicine book, and as you'd imagine, it just paralleled every single week's lesson. So I was able to study, different things like Rambam, so on, and Kabbalistic inyanim of healing from this book, Wings of the Sun, I think it was called.
Yeah, with Reb Nachman's teachings.
Yeah. And I was introduced to Rabbi Kramer's also Anatomy of the Soul around that time. They were both gifted to me. I didn't know they existed, those books. So Min HaShamayim, those books presented themselves to me at the time I was studying medical philosophy, Oriental medical philosophy. And around the same time, Rabbi Wolf, I don't know if you know Rabbi Label Wolf from Melbourne.
Yeah.
He put out a newsletter. And he was comparing things like, at the time Celestine Prophecies came out, and he was comparing things like Buddhism and Judaism, and it was just the most amazing newsletter, The Fellow Traveler's Guide, it was called. And I used to bring it in every week and share it with my teacher. So those things just happened to present themselves around that time. It was like a gift that I would not have known to search for. And I wasn't Torah learned enough to know what was in there. So it was just, not coincidence, obviously.
Mm-hmm. So you have that background, and now you have a role. You serve a tafkid, and Michael's asking, what do you see as your role in with your gifts and how you share them?
I mean, I never intended to practice when I left school. But I'd meet people and they'd have a problem and I'd offer to help, and then I'd help, and then they'd send somebody else over who had another problem, and then people started offering me money, and I was still a student. But I still had never considered practicing. It wasn't anything I thought to do. And then I just took off traveling again. But when people had issues, then I offered to help them. It just happened. Clients just happened like that. And then somehow I managed to somehow start to treat rabbis. And about 15 years ago in New York, I was asked to work with this rabbi who was a Makubal. And he would, whatever I said to him, he would just parallel it. He would just give me back amazing insights from Torah. It was the most incredible thing. So it didn't just teach me a load of stuff. It kind of reinforced for me and validated for me, I suppose, that what I was doing was okay, and more than okay. And he actually at that time wanted to set me up. He said what I had was priceless, what I had to offer was priceless. There was no greater gift to give people than their health back. And I think it was from then I realized that actually I could help Jewish people be healthier. Subsequently, I see how incredibly unhealthy we are. And I feel that, you know, it's incumbent upon us as Jews, especially Torah Jews, but all Jews, but especially Torah Jews, to actually to live the Torah. In order to live the Torah, you have to be healthy. And you have to take care of the health of the world.
Can you say more what you mean by that? What I mean is what it is about living a Torah life that would require someone to be healthy. And
you know, we know very well that if you're tired or hungry or sick, that, you know, your prayers aren't as valid as they would be if you were healthy, for example. It says in the Torah that we're not supposed to be sick. We're supposed to die of old age naturally, you know. And all the cures were given to us before the illnesses. Everything's there that we need. So there's no reason to be sick. And in order to do mitzvahs, to fulfill our purpose, to run, to do mitzvahs, to help each other, we need our energy, we need our health. So if we see ourselves as a gift from Hashem and we value that, then we have to value the body that we were given and treat it like a temple and not abuse it. Child abuse is one of the most heinous crimes on the planet, and yet we do things to ourselves every day that would be considered, you know, unbelievable abuse if we did it to children. And then, you know, as part of the external environment, if we are all one, and if Hashem gave us the world to look after, if we don't look after ourselves and we don't have enough respect for ourselves, how can we possibly have respect enough to look after our environment?
So how did you go from helping people with their health to then traveling around the world to help people with their health? Like, how do you find the people you work with?
Completely out of my hands. If somebody had said to me, you know, would you like an international client base? I would have sort of said, yeah, really? You know, how on earth would you ever go about getting one of those?
It sounds like an exotic animal.
Oh, yeah, I have no idea how it happened, none whatsoever. I worked with a woman in Australia who was American, and I was very impressed with her lectures. It's very difficult for me to say a lot because I have client confidentiality, so I can't use any names. But and I can't say too much because I don't want people to be identified, obviously. Mm-hmm. Some people I have permission to identify, and some people prefer to keep their, you know.
Sure, of course.
Their privacy. But this particular person, I offered a treatment because I was very inspired and impressed by her lecture tour. And she accepted. And when she went back to the States, she asked me for 6 months, wrote me for 6 months, inviting me to come over to New York. And I just kept writing back saying thanks, but no thanks, went there, didn't like it, I'm not coming again, you know, and no disrespect to any New Yorkers, but I had no interest to go back there. And it took actually 6 months for the penny to drop and for one day for me to go, hang on a second, I think Hashem's trying to tell me something here, because she was so persistent. And so one day I went, I think Hashem wants me to go to New York. So finally I said, okay, I'm coming. And she referred other people to me, and New York, I just, you know, got very busy there. I don't know how it happens really, but, you know, you sit down at a Shabbos table and invariably people know, who are you? What's your father's name? What do you do for a living? You know? Mm-hmm. Either that or like, why aren't you eating the first course, the second course, or the third course, mm-hmm. Or the fourth course? So it became quite difficult because I'd have to explain to people why I didn't want to eat, you know, the chopped liver or the chicken soup or the cholent or any of it. And that's quite challenging, to sit down at someone's Shabbos table and say, mm-hmm. well, you know, it's poison. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if when I started to tell people what I do, I'd sort of try and simplify it, and I'd just say, you know, I do alternative medicine, try and leave it there. But for some reason, people would say to me, oh, do you work with this? Do you work with cancer? Do you work with mental illness? Do you work with whatever? And invariably, by the end of Shabbos, you know, people would be finding my number from the host and ringing me up and booking appointments.
Well, I want to bring the idea of faith again, which you talked about with your mother and your grandmother, that this type of way of going from one place to another and to, you know, arrive in a place, and even though it wasn't your main purpose, there would be someone who is having trouble with the birth and you're just arriving and then helping that person. I mean, there's all these stories that you've told me that happened. And at the same, and another application of faith is really about with illness, where you're one of the few people I know where big scary labels of illness don't scare you, because you have faith that Hashem is the healer. Can you speak about that?
One of the things we learn early on is that there's a big difference between healing and curing. And one of the things I always say to people is, I can't cure or heal anybody. You know, that's up to God. It's not in my hands. I really don't resonate well when people introduce me as a healer, which is what happens oftentimes because they don't know what else to call me. But God's a healer, and everyone has their time. And there's a decree, I believe, you know, when your time's up, and if you're meant to get help, that help will come. And if you apply whatever the teachings are, then you may survive, and you may survive in a healthier way, as in being healed of whatever your emotional issues are, so that you can have a more fulfilling life. But there's no guarantee that, you know, you'll get cured just by using alternative medicine. So it's very important. Once I was with a family in South Africa, a very wise rabbi, and I was introduced as a healer, and I said this same thing, I'm not the healer. And he said, of course you're not a healer, God's the healer, you're just a shaliach. But they
He's
say...
a messenger.
Yeah, a messenger. And they say that, you know, in anybody's health journey, even if the decree is that they should die, sometimes there's a window of an opportunity to change that decree. And if I happen to come along at that point in that window, then it's not me that's doing the healing. It's just that was what was meant to happen. And then I can give the advice that's necessary to help that person make those changes to facilitate their healing. But I see myself as a facilitator, not as a healer.
Right. Well, I think that's part of why you are given this role, because you're not you're not claiming the responsibility for the healing. But even where you just gave, words cautioning that someone can't kind of expect a healing or a cure, at the same time, I think you also don't buy what the Western prognosis might be. You will receive someone's diagnosis, and that's helpful. It gives you information, but you also don't necessarily take that as written in stone either, because it's really up to Hashem to decide. What would you say about that?
Yeah, 100%. I think it's really irresponsible and very unkind for oncologists to give people a time limit. They're not God, and nobody knows. And I've worked with people who have gone into remission that have been told that there was no hope for them. And I've also worked with people who've been told they've got 3 months and have died literally 3 months to the day. So I don't see any point to it, because hope is, I think, one of the biggest healers. And as long as someone has hope, anything's possible. Hashem can do anything. So who are we to say, normally when you have this kind of cancer, you have 6 months. It's wrong. I think it's wrong.
Well, I think that's even true, even from a Western perspective, that when a person's hope and is very important, and that these sort of timelines can sometimes make people give up on trying. Stephen Jay Gould has an essay about when he was diagnosed with stomach cancer, and that his understanding of statistics meant he understood that the time frame the doctors were giving him was not only unhelpful but misleading.
Mm. Yeah.
And what?
Go on.
I'm sorry, you went from New York, and I'm just still trying to get even a short list of different countries.
Basically, wherever I have been, somebody or other is bound to sort of turn up with something wrong with them, and I help them. So it could be, the Philippines or Thailand or basically anywhere. There's so many countries that I pass through, and most often I don't think there's anywhere that I've ever been. Even sometimes on aeroplanes, somebody gets sick on an aeroplane and they call the doctor and the doctor can't do anything, and I go and interfere.
Were you just teaching cooking in a Chabad house in some Asian country recently? What were you doing with teaching cooking recently?
Yeah, I was with my friend Kevin and another friend, Arlene, from Jerusalem. And they're both amazing medicine cooks. And we went and did, we taught some brown rice sushi making, and we cooked vegan breakfast for my yoga students. They cooked, I just ate. It was actually a real privilege, because it's normally me doing all of it. But we had the idea that while I'm teaching the yoga to the people, then it would be really nice if they could follow that by having a useful breakfast instead of having to go off and eat some, less full food, let's say. I'm having to learn to use more diplomatic words other than rubbish or poison,
Right.
I'm often told off for my lack of tact.
And what do you, you didn't pick that up in England or New York or anywhere like that, I'm sure. Or Israel, that's for sure. What do you consider your role to? What's your relationship today with organized religion? Like, where in the Jewish, in the world of organized Jewish religion, or do you consider your religious beliefs and practice to be your own, and you don't really relate to organized religion in that way?
Well, off the record, because I wouldn't want to be quoted as saying this, but I've often said to people, if I'd have only stayed in England, I'd have probably become a Buddhist. Organized Judaism in this country for me is painful. Mm-hmm. Andrew knows me to be a bit more of a Kalbachian, and I love music and dance, and I love the joy, and I love the spirituality, and I think that it's really sad that there's so much organized Judaism in the world that's so dry and so lacking in the ability to teach people the thing that they most need, to reach people on the level that they really need to be connected to. I think, a lot of the Jewish organizations around the world are abysmal in terms of their awareness and environmental awareness and consciousness. And I think that, Mayor Abusera said it many years ago after a shiur I went to, a lesson I went to with him, that, you know, when you're studying Torah, you're supposed to get the light from the Torah. Why are so many people coming out with their heads bent looking so miserable? They're not shining. Why aren't they shining and looking joyful? So I feel blessed that because of my travels, I've encountered all sorts of different Judaism in all sorts of different countries, and I've been able to pick and choose, basically, Rabbonim that makes sense to me. And I know what depths it has to offer. Makes me sad that we don't have enough leaders to give that to the people.
Or it could just be that we need to find our own unique blends that work for ourselves, and you know that's what works. So
yes, but my issue with that is, as I said, if I'd have stayed in my hometown, most of my time, childhood in my shul, we didn't even have a rabbi. Pesach, if you couldn't afford to go to the communal Seder, that was it, too bad. And you never got invited anywhere. My mum, being a very attractive single woman, she was a threat to most married couples. We didn't get invited for Shabbos. I mean, had we have been left here and I'd never seen or experienced anything else, I wouldn't have known what else there was to look for.
Well, fortunately for you and fortunately for the world, you found many other places to visit and learn from and teach in. And I'm grateful for this conversation with you today, Amanda.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I know you're coming on Pesach. You often send out recipes. If it's all right with you, I'd love to share a couple of recipes that you recommend on our website with this podcast episode.
Sure. Welcome.
Boy, I mean, this was just so interesting. It's been so nice hearing your story and getting to know you, Amanda. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And thanks for your patience in allowing us to keep track with you until we finally were able to make this work.
Yeah, it did take a bit of patience, but now we've done it. That's great.
That's for sure. Well, we are just speaking with our guest, Amanda Wright, and I'm your host, Andrew Tertis, with Michael Unterberg, my co-host. And this is One Way Or, Jewish Questions and Musings. Please visit us on the website, onewayor.com, and on Facebook and Twitter.
One Way Or Podcast.
And please give your feedback, any other new topics you'd like us to cover.
Thanks so much.
Music is brought to you by Jewish blues pioneer, Saul Kay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Oh, you're funny, you two.